is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The authorities failed to stop the clashes despite a robust security force present in the town. We urge the authority to fully uphold the role of protection of population without discrimination.
That was Martha Hartad, spokeswoman for the UN Human Rights Office, which is urging Sudan to speed up deployment of security forces to West Darfur to protect civilians from violent ethnic and tribal clashes. Details coming up. Also, voters head to the polls in the Horn of Africa nation, Djibouti. And a new report from Freedom House says democratic norms are under increasing threat around the world. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Botswana's president says Southern African leaders have offered military support to Mozambique's troubled Cabo Delgado province to help stop a violent Islamist insurgency. However, it was not clear if the offer includes troops who would directly engage the insurgents or just military aid. Makhandisi Dube reports from Botswana's capital, Habrone.
In a televised address shortly after a summit of the regional bloc SADC on Thursday, President Mokgweetsi Masisi said regional intervention is necessary in the Mozambique conflict. Masisi is the SADC chairperson for the organ on politics, defense and security.
The countries of SADC are pledging support to Mozambique, material, emotional, psychosocial support, and of course including a defense, logistics and military support. The countries of SADC, consistent with the pact.
Masisi did not say whether the military support would be technical or boots on the ground, but SADC leaders cannot stand by and watch the brutalities in Mozambique escalate, he says.
It must be borne in mind that this is following an elongated period of brutal commitment of atrocities, heinous atrocities, where people's internal organs are taken out, where people are beheaded, pregnant women have their tummies slashed and unborn babies spewed all over the place. The brutality of the terrorists in Cabo Delgado are quite devastating.
Botswana's Minister of Defense and Security, Kagiso Moyi, told local media Thursday the army was ready for deployment in Mozambique. Mozambique's President Filipe Nyusi has resisted calls for SADC to intervene, but Masisi says the meeting participants agreed the regional bloc has to step in. However, Adriano Nuvunga, director of the Center for Democracy and Development in Maputo, questions SADC's capacity to intervene in such a crisis.
Mozambicans have been waiting for SADC intervention. Some people have been expecting that SADC could intervene militarily. But the next question is, does SADC have that capacity to militarily intervene in Mozambique? Looking at the strongest countries in the region, do they have the capacity to intervene militarily in that type of conflict that Mozambique is dealing with in northern Cabo Delgado?
The SADC summit was convened following recent attacks in the town of Palma, which left dozens dead. Mozambique has battled insurgents in the oil-rich Cabo Delgado region since 2017. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Habaroni.
Refugees in Kenya and their supporters are hailing a Kenyan court's temporarily halting a government plan to close two camps in the country. Kenya's Interior Ministry in March demanded the UN Refugee Agency's plan to close the Dadaab and the Kakuma camps, which are home to about 400,000 refugees and asylum seekers, mainly from Somalia and South Sudan. The ruling is the second time a Kenyan court has stopped authorities' attempts to close the camps, as Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
37-year-old Somali Abdullahi Ali has been living in the Dadaab refugee camp since 1992, when he fled Somalia's civil war and where he met his wife and had 7 children. He welcomed the Kenyan High Court's order Thursday to suspend the government move to shut down Dadaab in the country's east and Kakuma, another camp in the northwest. He says he is so happy with the court decision. The court has seen that it is not easy to close the camp and send all refugees home in a short period, says Ali. We want to thank those who took our case to court, he adds. The court ordered a 30-day halt after lawyer Peter Gishira filed a legal challenge to the Interior Minister's plan to close the camps. The ministry had given the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, until Wednesday to come up with a plan to close the camps, which are home to about 400,000 people. The UNHCR on Friday said it had shared its proposal with the Kenyan authorities. The statement said the plan included the voluntary repatriation in accordance with the COVID-19 health protocols and resettlement to third countries for refugees who cannot return for safety reasons. Kenya's Interior Ministry, which is in charge of refugee affairs, has not responded to requests for comment, but Kenyan media report the ministry is not happy with the UNHCR's proposal. Constitutional lawyer Bob Mukangi says Kenya cannot ignore local and international laws that protect the rights of refugees.
But also to go ahead and do it would be very difficult, considering that these refugee camps house over 400,000 people. And to simply say that you're closing them down is a huge logistical undertaking that cannot be done whimsically.
The Kenyan government has insisted the refugee camps pose a security threat and since 2014 have sought to have them closed. Amnesty International Kenya office head Irungu Hiton says the time is not right to close the camps.
This is not obviously a good time for Somalis, for Sudanese, for Ugandans, for even Tanzanians. And as we are seeing in the case of Tigray, Ethiopia, a new front of violence has opened up. And for many of those refugees, they are not assured of the safety or the protection that they require in order to return.
Hutton notes also that many refugees have not received coronavirus vaccinations, so moving them in large groups risk further spreading the virus. Kenya's Kakuma and Dadaab refugee camps have been open to close to 3 decades. At the height of conflicts and famine in Somalia, the Dadaab camp hosted more than 600,000 people, most of them Somalis. Since 2014, more than 80,000 Somali refugees have returned home from Kenya under the UN's voluntary repatriation program. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A new report from Freedom House says democratic norms are under increasing threat around the world. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Taimin, director of Africa Programs at the Washington think tank dedicated to promoting democracy and human rights. Taimin says his organization has reported a general decline in democratic freedoms around the world every year for the past 15 years.
And that pattern is reflected in Africa. The last year that we looked at, 2020, was one of the worst years, unfortunately, in terms of regressions on democracy and freedoms in Africa.
What kinds of democratic norms are you looking for?
We're looking at political rights and civil liberties and the environment in which elections take place. We're looking at freedom of movement, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, media freedoms, and increasingly at online freedoms. So the overall freedoms that citizens enjoy in any particular country.
I note that West Africa is of particular concern.
Yeah, we've definitely seen a significant democratic decline in West Africa in recent years. And that comes after a period where West Africa did relatively well. This past year, we saw a significant decline in Cote d'Ivoire related to elections and changing term limits. Also on term limits, we saw a decline in Guinea, where the president engineered a third term. Over a number of years, we've seen a notable decline in Burkina Faso. Last year, we saw a significant decline in Mali related to the coup there. Benin had a substantial decline last year, and Benin used to be a country that really performed very well in terms of democracy. And those declines are not limited only to West Africa. We've seen notable declines in Tanzania, in Mozambique, and elsewhere.
In fairness, there have been some positive signs for democracy in Africa as well.
And it's important not to lose sight of that. Sudan has shown some real improvements over the last couple of years. Malawi had a really important improvement this past year. Mauritania has shown some quiet but important improvements as well. So there are some bright spots.
Are there any new factors that tie some of these various forms of decline together?
There are some common factors that we see. One recently is the response to COVID. We see some leaders using the pretext of COVID to clamp down more broadly, limiting political gatherings, limiting political party activities that are disproportionately applied to opposition parties. I would cite examples in Zimbabwe as one and Uganda in another, but there are additional examples as well.
What are some other emerging challenges?
We see countries that are increasingly being repressive in the digital space and learning how to use digital tools to observe some of their opponents and also to limit free expression online. And that's happened in a number of countries. Ethiopia has shut down the internet. Zambia has problematic online legislation. A number of other countries have tried to use legislative tools to limit that space. And that issue is not going away anytime soon.
What can African citizens do to push back and make their governments more responsive and accountable?
The first thing to say is that citizens are already doing a lot, and we've seen a lot of resistance and much of it effective in recent years. You look at the revolution in Sudan, you look at some of the protests in Malawi that led to a positive change there, and you even look more recently at some of the protests in Senegal, in Nigeria. Citizens have become more savvy about how to use peaceful protests and how to really challenge governments that are not serving their interests. Of course, there are great risks associated with that, especially in Sudan. Many people have died trying to peacefully stand up to the previous regime.
What else can be done to bring nations back into the democratic fold or keep them there? What are you working on?
What I work a lot on in particular is more of the civil society piece and the media piece and the international engagement and the policy piece from abroad. I think it's all a combination of those factors, you know, citizens on the streets, plus more the civil society engagement, plus international pressure that we often look for.
That was John Taimin, who directs the Africa program at Freedom House, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The run-up to Benin's presidential election on Sunday has been marked by protests over what the opposition says is not a democratic process. VOA's Jason Patinkin speaks with journalist Rodrigue Azinobe in Benin.
Rodrigue, first, can you give an overview of the main candidates who are in this race?
Three pairs of candidates are running for the presidential election. We have President Patrice Talon, as well as two duet claim to belong to the opposition, but public are seeing them as an argument used by the ruling party. For example, we have Corentin Corre, who is candidate from RLC party, and Soumanou Diemba, who is candidate from FCB, the last party for the old president, Boni Yayi, who is not in this party now. And they are indeed candidates, but many Beninese do not find themselves in this choice, and they believe that this election is not similar to those which have taken place in our country since the beginning of the democratic system.
And many opposition members are actually not allowed to run. How are they and their supporters viewing this election?
Several candidates of the so-called radical opposition have had their candidacies rejected, which has resulted in the big frustration. Their supporters are shouting conspiracy and even project to boycott next Sunday election. They all seem to be waiting for a direction from their leaders, but for the moment, nothing is radio silence on their side. Of course, Ricky Amadougou, one of the leaders of the Democrat Party, is in prison. The other leaders are in exile, and those who are still in the country are silent. We are waiting. Perhaps tomorrow they can talk, and we will see.
And what is the government's view on this?
For the government, the process is in a good way, according to them complaints. They're still saying that everything's going good.
Last of all, there have been protests in recent days with one person killed. How is this affecting the polls?
Yes, the recent protests are the result of the outgoing president, President Talon. Normally, his term ends last Monday, but the new constitution allow him to still be on the power until a new president, which is not seen in the good way by the opposition. The northern party of the country that has been seriously affected by protests, the main road that connects north to south is still out of service and the military is scrambled to open it. Election material has not been yet deployed in this area, which could jeopardize the ballot in the region. Image of burnout truck carrying ballot and material has been circulating on social media since yesterday, prove that Sunday's vote will not be easy in the north part in Benin.
That was journalist Rodrigo Azinobe in Benin, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. On Sunday, Chad holds its presidential election with President Idriss Deby seeking another term in office. After 30 years in office, he is one of Africa's longest-serving leaders. VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson speaks with journalist Katarina Hoya, who is in N'Djamena, about the election.
President Idriss Deby, one of Africa's longest-serving presidents in power for 3 decades, is running for a 6th mandate despite mounting calls for him to step down and hand over power. He's facing 9 challengers in elections on Sunday. 3 out of those have pulled out of the race in recent weeks, saying the vote won't be free and fair, and they're calling for the supporters not to vote. Now, a low voter turnout risks the credit of Deby's 6th mandate. So you have his supporters ramping up their calls for voters to pick up their voting cards.
Now, what is the atmosphere in the country as we get closer to the election?
The lead-up to the vote has been marked by violent crackdowns on protesters calling for Deby to step down. There's also been arrests of opposition supporters and political leaders. And at the same time, you have Deby's supporters who are celebrating their leaders entering the campaign and going for 6th mandate. So the situation is tense between those two camps. That said, the capital in N'Djamena is still calm. There's a high military presence, and that's likely to remain during the election period and until the vote on Sunday to maintain security and order.
Now, there are reports that several political figures and other people were arrested today and last night over what the government was saying is a plot to sabotage the elections. Have you heard any details about that?
Well, the authorities have made a few statements saying they arrested a couple of individuals, including political leaders, accused of planning an attack on the Electoral Commission and also for planning to ransack polling stations. There's been a few names circulating, including some important opposition leaders. None of them are candidates in Sunday's elections. There was also security forces encircling the headquarters of Succès Mafra yesterday. Young opposition leader, 30 years of age, who wanted to be a candidate in elections, but whose candidacy was rejected because he didn't meet the lower age limit of 45 to be able to run.
That was journalist Katarina Hoya, who is reporting from Chad's capital in N'Djamena. She was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Voters headed to the polls today in the tiny but strategically important Horn of Africa nation, Djibouti. President Ismail Omar Guelleh is widely expected to win a 5th term and extend his 21-year-long rule. Djibouti, a nation of less than 1 million people, lies along one of the world's busiest shipping routes, the Gulf of Aden, and hosts U.S., Chinese, and French military bases. Guelleh faced only one challenger, relative newcomer Zaria Ismail Farah. The rest of the week, divided opposition boycotted the polls. Under Guelleh, Djibouti has invested heavily in port infrastructure, becoming the primary gateway to landlocked Ethiopia, Africa's second most populous nation. The UN Human Rights Office is urging Sudanese authorities to speed up the deployment of security forces to West Darfur. It is an effort to protect civilians from the all-too-frequent eruption of violent ethnic and tribal clashes in the region. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The latest resurgence of violence nearly 1 week ago has left more than 130 people dead and more than 200 injured, with thousands forced to flee their homes. This is the third eruption of violence between Mazalit and Arab tribes since former Sudanese dictator Omar al-Bashir was ousted and a transitional government took power in April 2019. Spokeswoman for the UN Human Rights Office, Marta Hurtado, says her agency is appalled by the carnage and disturbed by authorities' slow progress in holding the perpetrators of the violence accountable.
Similar to previous situations of violence in Al-Janina, the authorities failed to stop the clashes despite a robust security force present in the town. We urge the authority to fully uphold the role of protection of the population without discrimination. In this regard, we call on the government of Sudan to accelerate the implementation of the National Plan for the Protection of Civilians.
Clashes over land and access to water resources have been going on for decades between the Mazalit, who are mainly farmers, and the Arab herder tribes. The United Nations estimates the devastating war in Darfur that broke out in 2003 killed some 300,000 people and displaced 2.7 million. Hurtado says all tribes responsible for violence in Darfur must be disarmed and the state must maintain order and ensure the rule of law. This, she says, means authorities must prevent armed civilians from taking the law into their own hands.
We acknowledge that after the latest clashes, the authorities have taken steps to contain the situation in this area. We also welcome the government's commitment to addressing the root causes of the violence, especially disputes over land, pasture, and water resources, disputes that are at the heart of entrenched tribal divisions.
The Human Rights Office is calling for an independent, impartial, and thorough investigation into the acts of violence. It says effective accountability for crimes and justice for the victims will pave the way for reconciliation and lasting peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Archaeologists have uncovered a city built 3,400 years ago during the opulent reign of Amenhotep III, one of Egypt's most powerful pharaohs. Reuters reports that the well-preserved city had almost complete walls and rooms filled with tools of daily life, along with rings, scarabs, colored pottery vessels, and mud bricks bearing the seal of Amenhotep. Peter Lakovara, director of the U.S.-based Ancient Egyptian Heritage and Archaeology Fund, called it a very important discovery, saying it's sort of ancient Egypt's Pompeii and shows the critical need to preserve the area as an archaeological park. Betsy Bryan, a specialist of Amenhotep's reign, said the discovery opens up more details on how Egyptians lived under the great and wealthy ruler. Unidentified gunmen have killed 11 soldiers in Nigeria's Benue State. The army says the attack yesterday was unprovoked. Army spokesman Muhammad Yerma told reporters that initially the troops were declared missing while on a routine operational task, but a search and rescue team later found the bodies. Efforts are ongoing to track down the perpetrators, Yerma said. The violence in the restive Middle Belt region marks the latest bout of instability in Africa's most populous nation. Doctors Without Borders says troops patrol the Middle Belt due in part to clashes between farmers and nomadic cattle herders that have killed thousands and displaced 500,000 over the past decade. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 U.